It's me, your occasional benefactor and online bestie, Jamie Madigan. I'm the host of this podcast that you're listening to, The Psychology of Video Games. It's my mission in life to delve into the psychology of research and help you understand why good game design works, why games are marketed and sold as they are, and why gamers behave as we do. I do this every episode with the help of a guest expert. This is the episode about how we see our relationships with video game avatars. Before we get started, note that my Patreon supporters get an ad-free version of this podcast and bonus micro-podcast episodes just by supporting me over on patreon.com/POG. That's for Psychology of Games. If you can't or don't want to do that, you can help me out by rating the podcast on iTunes or wherever, or by following and sharing my stuff on Twitter and Facebook. Links for that can be found at psychologyofgames.com, where I've carefully arranged years of worth of articles for you to read as you explore the intersection of psychology and video games. So take your pick, and however you might choose to help me out, it's definitely appreciated. You're awesome. Think about the last avatar you controlled in a video game. What did he, she, or it mean to you? Was it just a tool that you used to get from one end of a maze to another? Was it a richly detailed character that might have been pulled from any given movie, television show, or novel? Or was it something that you created, tweaked, and customized from whole cloth, well, digital whole cloth, to look just how you wanted and behaved exactly as you thought appropriate? The way that we think about our avatars and the kinds of relationships that we develop with them can impact how we feel about a game, what choices we make in games, and how we interact with other players. This may be especially true for games where you get to design your own avatar, but I think it's also relevant to games where you have to take control of a character and engage with the in-game world through its perspective. Joel, the protagonist in the third-person action-adventure game The Last of Us, isn't exactly the kind of character I would choose to represent me if I had the choice. But playing the game as him and co-creating the game's narrative with him, or more to the point, the game's writers, was a really compelling experience because I not only had a strong sense of who Joel was, but influencing the world through him gave the whole experience more dramatic heft and meaning, much more so than I would have gotten from just reading about or watching him. Among different kinds of media, video games are kind of unique in how they allow us to interact with and develop something approaching a real interpersonal relationship with characters. So it's an interesting question for those working in the realms of psychology and communications research to ask exactly how this works. What determines what kinds of relationships you'll have with your avatar? What characterizes those relationships? What effects do they have on your enjoyment of the game or other outcomes? These are the kinds of questions that I will tackle with the help of my guest expert on this episode of the podcast. All right, everybody, welcome once again to the interview portion of the podcast. My guest expert this episode is Dr. Jamie Banks. She's an assistant professor at West Virginia University's Department of Communication Studies, where she studies avatar interactions and other various topics. Jamie, thanks for coming on.
Sure, no problem. Glad to be here.
I'm excited to have a multiple Jamie podcast, Jamie and Jamie here with you. If people have trouble telling us apart, I guess they could keep in mind that we do spell our names differently. I am J-A-M-I-E, and you, I think, are J-A-I-M-E.
I am. It comes from the actress who played Wonder Woman.
Oh, there you go. So if you have trouble telling us apart, just keep that in mind. But thanks for coming here regardless.
Thank you.
So who are you and what are you doing here?
All right. You heard I'm Jamie Banks. I'm here today to talk a little bit about player avatar relationships. It has been my primary area of study for about 8 years now. More broadly, I am very interested in different types of human technology relationships. The player avatar relationship as a phenomenon has a very special place in my heart, and was really sort of the reason that I shifted into an academic career in the first place. I was fascinated by it and fascinated by all the different variations of it. And just it took me in this direction that has been a really cool area of research for me.
Very cool. So before we get into kind of the topics at hand, you are working along with some of your colleagues on an exhibit
Indeed.
That West Virginia University Communications Department is going to be putting on that deals with players and their avatars and the stories surrounding them. Do you want to tell me a little bit about that exhibit, like what it is? And I believe that by the time this goes up, there will still be an opportunity for people to submit entries that might be featured in that.
Yes, there will be. So in general, the project is a collaboration. Nick Bowman and I, who is a colleague in the Communication Studies Department, he and I have done a lot of this player avatar relationship work together. And it's actually sponsored by WVU Libraries. And we are basically doing an oral history project. You know, a lot of times what we do as researchers is we publish for our field, for other researchers like us to, you know, try to unpack different types of things that are going on in the world. But a lot of times we don't get an opportunity to actually take all of this knowledge that we generate and return it to people outside of the academic community. And that's really the aim of this project, to take the ideas that we have and all of the frameworks that we've developed about how players connect with their avatars and show the rest of the world what this actually means in a way that is sort of meaningful and accessible to them. So we're asking video gamers, mostly sort of what we're interested in is multiplayer, customizable type games and players of those games. And we want to know, what is your most favorite memory with your most favorite avatar? And so there's sort of two phases to this project. And the first one is a very short survey where you just go in and you tell us what you think. What is your favorite memory? And, you know, in exchange for doing that, we've actually been able to get some funding so that we'll do a drawing for $150 Amazon gift card among all of the people who participate in that first part. And then among all of those different submissions for the first part, we will take anywhere between a dozen and 20 of those and invite those people to participate in the second part. And that is actually the oral history collection. There's going to be an in-library actual physical exhibit where for the months of October, November, and December, we're going to have player-submitted images go along with their stories, and they will appear in the library. And then we're going to do a longer-term permanent collection in the library's digital collections that will be 100 different stories.
Cool.
And they will sort of represent this body of knowledge that comes directly from players and that can be relevant to lots of different kinds of people to try to tell this story about why avatars matter in people's lives.
Nice. So I love the idea, by the way, that you have this virtual avatar concept and these stories about these virtual relationships that's going to be enshrined in an actual physical location in the library.
Exactly.
I think that's pretty cool. And then it also sounds like there'll be a digital version as well.
Yes, indeed.
So I will, I'll have a link to the survey that people can follow to participate in that up on the website and especially the blog post that goes with this episode of the podcast. So if you're probably not going to submit your own entry, or maybe you are, but you know, if you were, what would be one of your favorite memories about you and your avatar?
It would have to be the event that made me realize that player avatar relationships could be a thing and that they weren't exactly always how the existing scientific literature says they are.
Okay.
And so this was, I had just started playing World of Warcraft. I think it would have been at the end of Wrath of the Lich King expansion. And I was playing a hunter, and it's my favorite class. It's kind of a chill class. And I was trying to tame Arcturus. And Arcturus is this bear. And so a bit of background, of course, hunters have combat pets. Mm-hmm. And so you go out and tame your combat pet. And I had been camping out for weeks trying to tame this bear. And I never quite matched up in the timing. And finally, I tamed it, or I was attempting to tame it when he came around, and I accidentally killed it because I had forgotten to release my existing pet.
Oh, no.
Well, so I waited another week or so, and Arcturus came around, and I did manage to tame it. I played on a PvP server, so I was like, I'm getting out of here for a minute. And so I got on my mount, and I went into this sort of remote area of Northrend, and I just summoned this bear for the first time. And I was like, wow, this thing is beautiful. And I took a second and I got to know it. And it was like a semi-spiritual experience. I know that sounds totally crazy, but I was just like,
I was in
awe of this digital thing's beauty. And, you know, at that moment, I realized, wait, I'm like getting emotional about this. What the heck is even going on here? And it was sort of in that moment when that hunter, that character, found that pet that she became more than just me. It was sort of like they were supposed to go together. And that made them, it made my character, my avatar, bigger than a merely an extension of me. She sort of took on somehow a life of her own and a story of her own. And it just kind of went beyond a lot of the existing literature that was about, you know, identification is the most, you know, dramatic or most important or most intimate relationship you can have with your avatar, because she became something else.
Nice. Yeah. That's a pretty cool story that I bet a lot of people can identify with. So we've been talking about avatars, but let's back up just a second and let me ask, what do researchers like yourselves, like, how do you define what an avatar is? Because I think people may have slightly different perceptions of it and different definitions, and those definitions may be more or less valid depending on the context or the situation. But when you're studying this kind of thing, what do you consider to be an avatar?
So in the fields, you know, the terms avatar and character sort of get used interchangeably. I even slipped back into it myself when I was just telling my story, but there's sort of a difference. And the way I tend to look at it, and the way that I know some other scholars tend to look at it, an avatar is an extension of a player's agency into the game world. And when I say agency, I'm talking about an extension of the player's intention to do something in that space, right, and to matter in that environment.
So their ability to make stuff happen in the game.
Right. So us as humans cannot stick our fingers into the digital space and make things happen, but we can use all of our different interface elements to make that character do those things for us. Right. And so in that sense, an avatar is an extension of agency. A character is also an extension of agency, but where they actually differ is in this idea that these digital bodies can also be extensions of our identities to some extent or another, where a character is sort of this predefined personality. You know, it's defined by the game for you. But an avatar is one where you generally can sort of craft it, right? You might advance it, advance its characteristics. You might choose its name and its roles and its affiliations and its appearance in the same way that I chose that bear as my hunter's pet, right? So there's a potential when it comes to avatars to be able to craft a persona that is native to you rather than being defined by the game's design.
Okay, so Nathan Drake from the Uncharted games is more of a character, while any character from an MMO is probably an avatar.
Exactly.
Yeah. Okay, makes sense. So when I was reading over some of the articles and book chapters that you recommended to kind of prepare for this conversation, one of the things I noticed is that a lot of the current research on avatars that's being done in the communications and the psychology spaces grew out of this much like older concept of parasocial relationships. And these, from what I understand, are the kind of, it's kind of when you think that you have or feel like you have a relationship with a person that's mediated by some sort of technology. So a person in a video game or on a television show, like back in the old days, the original research was literally around, you know, like talk show hosts or news anchors and people feeling like I have a relationship with Tom Brokaw or Johnny Carson or whatever it might have been. Because when they say, you know, good night, America, I feel like they're talking to me. And then obviously that's a concept that was easy to apply to video games once those came on the scene. So how has the emergence of video games changed how researchers think about parasocial relationships, and are those relationships different in games versus other media?
Sure. I think that for a long time, it actually didn't change how they were thinking about it, because there was just this, as in many different domains, when a new technology comes out or a technology changes, we sort of just take what has happened or sort of what has worked before and apply it to the new space until we're given a reason not to. But so for a while here, we had this parasocial perspective. And when we say parasocial relationships, sort of the definition of that is that it's one way, and it basically exists in the media user's mind, right? Mm-hmm. Right. So there's not a fully materialized relationship in the sense that I'm influencing the character and the character is influencing me. The character is influencing me, but I am not offering any sort of material influence back. Right. Well, what happened with video games, of course, is through interactivity, different modes of interactivity, all of a sudden, we actually do have the ability to influence the media character back. And so we exist in sort of these information loops with our video game avatars in particular, where we deliver information to the character, to the avatar, through the different input devices we have at our disposal, and it influences their behavior in the space, but they also communicate back to us. For instance, when my avatar says, I don't have enough mana, you know, they're sort of influencing and changing my behavior. Mm-hmm. So it is an inherently, according to my view, it's an inherently social relationship in that it is, we are existing in these information loops. And sort of a question that has come up in reframing it that way is merely a matter of to what extent are people recognizing it as social or not.
Right. Yeah, because in video games, there is more of a two-way interaction that as you just said, the characters, or see, I did it, the avatars or characters do things that influence you, and thus you do have some sort of relationship. So I guess it's then left to the researchers like yourself to figure out what the boundaries are of that relationships and the characteristics of it. And this is a thought that's kind of tangential to what we're talking about, but one that definitely comes up is that relationships that people have with like Twitch streamers or YouTube mm-hmm. streamers, right? Those are different types of parasocial relationships, because again, like, you can do things that influence a Twitch streamer. You know, you can talk and chat, you can make donations, you can be a subscriber that gets you attention. And I know for a fact that some people are studying those kinds of relationships and trying to do research in that. I've talked to some of them recently, and I'm look forward to seeing what comes out of that as well.
Definitely. And you know, the interesting thing on that one is, whereas video games necessarily require you to do something with your character or with the game interface to make the game content and events actually unfold, you actually have a choice when it comes to game streaming, right? Mm-hmm. You can sit there and just watch it passively, in which case, if you're never actually interacting with the Twitch streamer, the personality, then that would be a parasocial relationship because there's no feedback. Right. There's no back and forth.
But just if you their viewer number goes up by one, which isn't
right.
much.
Right. But if you do engage them, then that has the potential to actually be a social relationship.
Yeah. Great. So how do players typically view their avatars? Kind of walk us through, you know, I know that there are four general types of avatar relationships or typologies that have been identified. So can you kind of walk us through that? Maybe we can play a little game where name one and explain what it is, and then I'll see if I can guess a game that probably fits it. Let's see how well I do.
Okay, good deal. This will be a fun game because I'm not sure it's one that that we can actually play. But we'll
That's
see
the
how
best
it goes.
Kind.
I know. So, you know, you had asked what the typical relationship or how people normally think and feel about their avatars. And the cool thing is, when it comes down to the model that we've developed here, is that there is no typical way. Hmm. But there are these four archetypes of relationships. And we can think about them as moving from less social to more social, where the least social is an avatar as object orientation. Then we move to an avatar as me orientation, avatar as symbiote, and then avatar as other. So let's start out with the avatar as object. An avatar as object relationship is one where the player is sort of oriented toward their avatar as though it is a mere tool to play the game. It is just a thing on a screen, and the fact that it has a face or a name or, you know, magical spells doesn't actually matter all that much, so long as they can push some buttons and things that they want to happen in the game can happen in the game. Okay. And these people tend to be more motivated by achievement and by competitive types of gameplay. So that's the first one.
So that might be like Pac-Man would be an example of where most people would view it as an object. It's never good when one of your professors goes,
It's tricky for me to think about it from a game perspective because I've heard so many people talk about the exact same type of character in so completely different ways that it's tricky to think of that as only fitting into one box. Right.
I see. So I guess the idea here is that different people could view the same avatar as a different type.
Right. So let's say, you know, if you're playing Pac-Man at the arcade and you are all about sort of getting the high score, seeing how many, you know, how far you can advance, then you might be more likely to actually look at it as that object, right? But, you know, if you were to, I don't know, come up with a story in your head about the fact that Pac-Man actually has to go home at night,
yeah,
then you might be less inclined to think of it as an object.
He just hates ghosts and he's always hungry.
Right.
Yeah.
So as soon as you start to imbue the avatar, the character, with some sort of a story, you start to move away from that object or non-social end of the spectrum. Mm.
Okay. So avatar's object is the first type. What's the next? Right.
The next one is avatar as me. And that is a lot of what we were talking about before, where it is an orientation towards your avatar as though it is an extension of your identity into the game, right? So people who have this type of relationship, they use a lot more first-person pronouns when they're referring to their avatar. It's I and it's me, right? Mm-hmm. But they also tend to go into these very meaningful constructions of what their avatar is and what it looks like. You know, for instance, I did an interview with a guy who he was a wildlife biology major and he lived out in the middle of the woods and played World of Warcraft by satellite internet.
Okay. I'm digging it. All right. I got a picture in my head.
he had a Nordic background in his lineage. And so he created a dwarf hunter. And the thing, his field of study focused on I think it was like the feeding systems of this particular kind of owl. And so his character was this hunter because he lived out in the forest and sometimes hunted for his food. And he had an owl as his combat pet. And he, you know, the dwarves have these big old beards and he had sort of one of those helmets that have the horns coming out. So it looked a little Vikingish. So he had basically pieced together a lot of different symbols that were available in the game to make it either in part look like him, but also represent him and his identity, his background and his occupation in different sorts of ways.
Okay.
So these people tend to be a little bit more oriented towards social types of gameplay and toward ritualistic gameplay. So these people want to go in the game and play with their friends as themselves, not as anybody else, right? And, you know, it's a lot about sort of, they tend to talk more about when they come home from work at the end of the day, they habitually flip on WoW and do their dailies, right? They tend to engage more in that kind of talk.
So what's the next type?
The next type is avatar as symbiote. And these are kind of the most fascinating people to me, or types of relationships. So it's a little bit tricky to talk about avatar as symbiote without talking about avatar as other. So I actually want to talk about them first, if that's all right.
Yeah.
So the avatar as other type of relationship sees the avatar as a legitimate social being. In and of itself, they tend to think of it as existing in the world in the game world in a particular way.
Okay.
So they have a role in the world, and they have a story in the world. They have a past existence before, you know, the player ever created them. They have friends and relationships, and they, to some extent or another, you know, a lot of avatars, other type players, tend to think and talk about what happens with their avatar when they log out, that it still effectively exists. And while this is a little bit more common among role players, it's not exclusive to role players. A lot of players develop a sense of like a headcanon around their character, or a story that they engage in their heads during their own gameplay that still matches up with the, you know, the formal lore, the canonical lore of a game world. Mm-hmm. It matches up, but it's not the same. So for instance, you know, one player was talking about when they had to quit playing World of Warcraft. And again, sorry, that's just where most of my work has been done.
Oh, yeah.
It's been a while.
It's a good touchstone. Yeah, no worries.
And so he played an orc, and he said, well, when I had to quit the game, I didn't want to just like leave it sitting somewhere that didn't matter to him. And so he took him back to the good old Barrens and sat him on the top of the hill and just said that he logged him out there because he imagined his character growing old in the Barrens, sitting at the top of the hill, smoking a pipe and telling all of the stories to the youngins. So it is still a story that makes sense because the Barrens mean something, and sort of an orc and the role of stories means something in the world. So it fits, but it belonged to that player specifically.
Yeah, and if you're going to pick a place to sit around and do nothing, the Barrens is a pretty good choice. World of Warcraft, because that's most of what your gameplay time there was spent doing anyway.
Right.
So these are people who are creating stories.
Effectively, yeah.
And these are characters in those stories that go on while they aren't necessarily playing.
Right. And because they have stories, they are sort of cohesive personas in themselves, so that, you know, these players often talk about their avatars as companions in gameplay, that they're sort of doing these adventures together. Mm-hmm. To the point where, you know, in some of the more extreme versions of this, the player feels as though it's their responsibility to make the game unfold in the way that the avatar as a being would want.
Okay.
You know, for instance, there was a player I interviewed who, you know, there's the famous torture quest in Northrend where you have to like zap the guy with this like electric prod to get him to you know, talk. And this player had this sort of almost pacifist avatar. And he said, I, as a gamer, want to do that quest, and I want to see what happens next and move forward in the quest line.
Mm-hmm.
But he said, I couldn't do that with this avatar, because he would never do that. It would be sort of a dishonor to make my avatar do this. So it's kind of a weird flopping of roles and responsibilities and agency in terms of like who's actually in charge here. And to the point where it's almost like some of these players will describe themselves as an avatar of the player.
Yeah. Oh, that's interesting.
Right?
Yeah. So are these players less likely to do things in the game that are sort of inconsistent with what they think the avatar would do in other ways? Like they wouldn't fast travel because this character can't just magically teleport across the city or the game world.
I'll tell you that I haven't encountered that yet. You know, because there's a certain level of suspension of disbelief that happens across all sorts of player types, all sorts of relationship types. That is, we may want to believe in the story, right? Mm-hmm. But we still have to efficiently play the game. Otherwise it stops being fun.
Yeah,
right?
Sure.
There was Jay Posey was his name. He's a designer and spoke at GDC a couple of years ago. And you can look up his talk. It's called Tastes Like Chicken. And he talks about the value of, you know, having this middle ground in games where, you know, his example was a warfare themed game. I apologize, I can't remember which one. But he said, you don't want to sit in a foxhole for 3 days,
yeah,
right? You want to sit in a foxhole for 30 seconds. and just get the taste of it rather than actually the full authentic experience. And so I think that's where we often see a middle ground here when it comes to suspension of disbelief, where, you know, I want to suspend disbelief that this isn't real and experience it as real, but only as long as it's still fun.
Yeah. Then you have those real hardcore simulation players like Arma 2, where you will literally crawl through the woods, like, you know, an inch at a time in that game just for the sake of realism. But I guess even that has its limits because in real life, you would probably be sitting around doing nothing for much longer stretches. So did we get through all four types or was
no,
there more?
No, we did. We needed to go back to the symbiotes because the cool thing about Avatar's symbiote orientations is that they sit somewhere in the middle of Avatar is me and Avatar is other. And sometimes they act like one or the other and they may switch back and forth.
Okay.
So Avatar is symbiotes. One of their hallmarks is that they, the phrasing that I've started to use in some of my research is they see themselves as part of each other. That is, the Avatar is sort of crosses the boundaries and becomes me sometimes, and I cross the boundary and become my Avatar sometimes. And I know this is kind of like a weird concept if you haven't really heard the people tell their stories, which is part of the reason for the oral history project, but it might make a little bit more sense with an example. So a lot of people who fit into this relationship category are people who are dealing with lots of personal trauma or conflict or sort of life drama. And I don't mean to diminish many of their situations because many of them are very, serious situations. So there was, to give you an example, I've come across lots of abused women who fall into this category. And they craft characters, they craft avatars that are very strong women. So they are usually like, you might see them as, let's say, a Death Knight in World of Warcraft who wears, you know, the armor kini and just has this very aggressive role in the game. Right. And they use that avatar as a way to practice being powerful. And when they find something that works for them, they seem to take whatever the behavior or the language or the habit is and then test it out in their everyday life. And if it works, they sort of integrate that into who they are. So in this instance, in that kind of situation, it's not that the player is taking a way that they see themselves and implementing it in the avatar as an avatar as me type of player would. Right. They are actually taking something from the avatar and bringing it into their own life to the point where people, you know, have done this, repeatedly and progressively, to the point where they felt like it would allow them to get out of their abusive relationships.
Right.
Another instance was someone who had an alcohol addiction. And so, you know, they used sort of the lore of blood elves in World of Warcraft who are addicted to magic as a way to work through and think about what their addiction actually was.
Yeah.
Both as their weakness and their source of power. So there's this interesting back and forth where I think that people who are in the avatar as symbiote relationship don't stay there very long because they will eventually, because of what seem to be their common motivations of making themselves better or making their situations better or resolving some conflict, they might move toward one or the other.
Interesting. So I imagine that different games or different characteristics of games make a person more or less likely to view their avatar in these different ways, or might facilitate it to a greater or lesser degree. You know, something like playing The Sims gives a person the opportunity to create an avatar and interact with an avatar that makes them a lot like them. Like, I can make it look like me. I can make it, you know, have my same interests. Mm-hmm. Where something like The Last of Us, you know, playing as Joel in The Last of Us, Joel's Joel. And unless you're like Joel, in which case that's unfortunate, you know, it's going to be more of an avatar as an object, maybe. And you might have a more difficult time sort of seeing that avatar in different ways. Is that the case, or am I off base here?
You're not off base, but it's complicated. And I don't think we actually have a good handle on this yet. Customization definitely can play a role, because if you are to sort of, if you are motivated to put yourself in an avatar as me orientation, you want all of those different resources, right? To make that avatar like you, either visually and aesthetically or symbolically. Mm-hmm. So you, if the game doesn't give you those resources, you may be less likely to develop that type of relationship with your character, right?
Or play that game in the first place, I imagine.
Indeed, certainly. And, you know, that goes back to this idea that, for instance, Avatar's other orientations rely a lot on escapism and immersion. So if you are driven to escape your daily life, that's your motivation for playing video games, relaxation from, you know, escape. If you can't see your character as as being a companion, you may be less likely to fall into that archetype, right? Hmm.
Yeah,
and we have noticed. Nick Bowman, my colleague in this work, did a little bit of work on genre, and genre is a whole different problematic beast in itself when it comes to modern video games. But we did see some patterns in different genres and players' propensity to sort of sit themselves in one of these different types of relationships. And the key one that stood out was actually science fiction games. And so if you think about, we classify EVE Online as a science fiction game. You know, that's open for debate. But if you think about what your avatar actually is in that game, you don't have a little like humanoid body that you move around, right?
Yeah, it's a ship, right?
You primarily manipulate a ship. So yeah. It would make sense that you would be less likely to see that as some sort of social agent. Right. So we did see some of those patterns, and you know, you can consider games like maybe Star Wars, The Old Republic, where you may be more apt to play something that doesn't look so human. And if it looks less human, maybe you are apt to look at it in a different way. You know, one of the factors in all of this is how human-like do you see your avatar as being? And so if it's less human in its appearance, you might be less likely to think about it in a human fashion.
Yeah. Yeah, and I think it probably has a lot to do with what you think other people's expectations of your avatar, given its appearance, might be. That if you expect people to react to you as a non-human or a very ugly human, or even just as male or female, that the way that you expect other people for you to behave would impact how you actually do behave. And that actually, I just described something called the Proteus effect, that Nick Yi discovered and researched and wrote about. And I had him on the podcast a long time ago to talk about that sort of stuff. But yeah, he talked about avatars and how our avatar looks can subtly at times influence our behavior, both socially and mechanically within a game.
Sure. And when it comes to sort of the perceptions and expectations of others, something, a very recent project we published, and this was my work with Caleb Carr out of Illinois State, we found that when we're talking about an avatar-mediated interaction, that is, I am playing with an avatar that interacts with other avatars that another player is playing, that we were able to statistically show that people, there are actually four agents in that interaction. We tend to think of it only as two, that is sort of a unit that is each player and their avatar, but we have a relationship with our avatars. Our avatars are seen as different than the other person's avatar, and we actively distinguish between what the avatar on the screen is and what the player behind it is. And this, of course, relies on a good bit of imagination in terms of what we can't see, based on some of the cues that we do get from the other player's avatar. But there are actually four distinct beings that people are experiencing when they're playing a game.
Yeah. So what is that, like five or six different relationships? We have
six
my avatar, me and my avatar and the other player's avatar, the other player's avatar and the other player, my avatar and the other player, me and the other player. I guess there's fully cross design there to work with.
Exactly.
Yeah. Great. So you mentioned Nick Bowman, who's also at West Virginia University and who I've also had on the podcast in the past, that you've worked with him, and you too recently published a paper where you created or conceptualized and tested a way to measure player avatar interactions. And it was a really interesting read, and I just kind of wanted to walk through that. So what is this concept of player avatar interactions, and what kinds of things drive player avatar interactions?
Sure. So if the four categories of relationships that we just talked about are, let's think about those like buckets, right? And so the question is,
I love buckets. Great. I'm on board.
What are we going to fill those buckets with? Player avatar interaction is really the psychological and social mechanisms that lead people to one of those buckets. Okay. So there's four components. The first is emotional investment. And that's basically, how much am I emotionally connected to, or, well, it's circular, but invested in my avatar.
You did this sneaky researcher thing of defining a thing as itself.
The tautology is cool.
But you're hardly the first to do so, so please proceed.
So to what extent is the avatar special to me? How much do I care about it? If I lost it, how sad would I be? Do I have a certain level of appreciation for my avatar? So this is sort of like a positive feeling that I have toward the avatar. Okay, so that's factor one. Factor two is what we call anthropomorphic autonomy.
Oh, mouthful.
I know, it is. But basically, it's sort of like, to what extent do I think my avatar exists in that world in a human-like fashion? So that thing we were talking about that tends to be very high among avatars' other orientations. So this is a question of, do I think it has its own thoughts and ideas and feelings? Do I think that it could act on its own or does act on its own? And when I log out, does that avatar have its own life? So it exists. It is sort of a cohesive being that acts on its own.
Okay.
And then the third factor is suspension of disbelief. And this is the extent to which we will willingly let go of our knowledge that this isn't real, that that character and its world are not real. Mm-hmm. And so, if we constantly are picking apart inconsistencies, trying to find, gaps in the lore or breaks in the lore, or if I am constantly aware that the raid resets every week, or... if I am constantly trying to figure out why my avatar doesn't fit into the world, then that's going to break it for me. And I'm less likely to see it as a social being. Mm-hmm. And then the last one is a sense of control. And sense of control is that feeling of agency, that feeling that what my avatar, I am telling my avatar to do, it's actually doing. I feel in control of what it's doing. So while, again, going back to our player avatar relationship spectrum, from non-social to social, object, me, symbiote, other, those first three, when they're higher, you tend to be higher up on the relational sociality spectrum. That is, you see it more like an other. So higher emotional investment, higher human likeness, higher suspension of disbelief, you're more likely to fit in one of those more social buckets. But sense of control actually works in the opposite. If you feel like you're more in control, you're more likely to see your avatar as a tool to play the game or as just a representation of yourself, because that's you.
So those things will determine what sort of interaction or player avatar interactions we have. So what did you conclude, or what did you find from that research, and what was most interesting?
So, in terms of the player interaction, in terms of the player avatar interaction scale, or PAX,
we should note that's what PAX stands for in this case. It has nothing to do with the formerly known as Penny Arcade Expo.
Right.
The title of the paper really threw me for a minute. I'm like, is this something she presented at PAX? What is, we have a PAX scale. That's pretty good. But it's right. Player avatar interaction, X for interaction. Got right. it. Sorry to interrupt.
That's all right. It's easier to say than PAI, P-A-I.
True. Although PAI, everybody likes PAI.
Indeed. It is at least not a lie. So what we found here, what was kind of interesting is the way that this project actually came about was that, so my colleague, Nick Bowman, he was actually sort of one of the scholars who was taking up the parasocial interaction perspective. And I was one of the scholars taking up this social interaction perspective. And we had many different fights about what was actually the right way to do this. And the way that this particular model came about is we just basically took all of my stuff and all of his stuff and put it in a bucket to see what would win.
Okay. And, tried and true scientific method. Got it.
And it turns out that it's half and half.
Yeah. So, also a tried and true scientific outcome. Yep.
Right.
It depends.
I won't let him forget that I might have been more right, though. So, you know, when we're thinking about those first two factors, emotional investment and anthropomorphic autonomy, that is, how much do I care and how human-like is it? Those explain sort of the most bit of differences in people's orientations to their avatars. And then suspension of disbelief and sense of control actually came from the old parasocial model. And so we can think about those first two as sort of more human-like factors or social factors. And we can think of the bottom two, suspension of disbelief and sense of control, as more media and interactivity factors. And so okay. It actually, if you think, it makes perfect sense when we think about it now, that an avatar is a piece of media content that is equal parts technology and sort of, it has this human-like wrapping or this agentic or, you know, social wrapping around it. So it makes sense that it would actually have both of those types of components when we're trying to explain this complete spectrum of how people in lots of different ways connect with their avatars.
So what does it matter? sorry, perhaps I phrased that inelegantly, but you know, what does it affect? You know, the level of player avatar interaction we have or the different ways that we view our avatars, like what are the outcomes? Does it affect how we play or enjoy games or what?
So the old parasocial and identification-oriented perspective has found that our connections with our avatars in lots of different ways impact enjoyment, appreciation, immersion, all sorts of different gameplay outcomes. This is still a relatively new perspective, and so we are moving to take the next steps in trying to make those same explorations through this new model, which accounts for not just basically the parasocial model focuses on avatar as object and avatar as me, but we're leaving off that whole other end of the spectrum. So a lot of that same work needs to be replicated now using this more comprehensive model. So the short answer is we don't exactly know yet, but we're working on it.
Okay.
But in the broadest sense, you know, if avatars are our vehicles for accessing these game worlds, then we could expect that our relationship with our avatar would moderate all sorts of different types of gameplay experiences. Mm-hmm. Let's think about the current video game violence debate. It might matter in answering this question about the relationship between violent content and aggressive states, if they even exist, you know, if there are differences in how we're orienting ourselves toward the tool used to engage that violent content. So a person who sees their avatar as me, that would suggest they might be considering themselves as the ones committing violent acts in the game. Whereas if I see my avatar as a different being, we might be able to engage in what we might call a form of like moral disengagement. Well, it's my avatar doing that bad stuff, not me. And that may have an impact on different types of different types of effects. And that same type of logic could extend to things like therapeutic uses of games. For instance, you know, there's a bit of work being done on veterans' gaming habits and how they use games to cope. It can have implications for how games are used in education. You know, there's some work that's been done on stereotype threat or sort of this idea that, you know, if you give someone, let me see if I can remember the study. if you have someone play a math game, if they're primed with the stereotype that women are worse at math than men, and you give them a female avatar, then that might reinforce the stereotype and make them perform worse, if I'm remembering this correctly. And so the extent to which we might be able to use avatars to overcome stereotype threat,
Yeah.
Or to leverage positive stereotypes, that could matter. And let's not forget about fun, right? Because we may sort of, these player avatar relationships may actually result in different types of enjoyment or different pathways to enjoyment, right? And I think that a lot of gameplay effects, you know, the work often tends to focus on these more serious gaming outcomes, but sometimes maybe we just need to think a little bit more clearly about entertainment. And I could see lots of different pathways where different orientations toward your avatar may result in different levels or different types of enjoyment.
Yeah, and that's sort of the main question, right? That's enjoyment and fun are the main things that both game developers and most game players most frequently want out of a game, right? You're usually playing to have a good time. And there may be things that come with that, like escapism and other aspects of it, but that's why most of us are playing games.
And, you know, sort of the flip side of this is in entertainment theory, the work done by Art Rainey and Mary Beth Oliver, entertainment theory suggests there are actually two parts to entertainment, right? There's the hedonic fun, and there's what we call eudaimonic appreciation. And that side of the entertainment coin really has to do with feelings of elevation and awe and inspiration, and really reflecting on things like the human condition and differences between good and evil. Right. And we know that those in games, sort of the enjoyment side of the coin often comes from challenge and, you know, the epic and things like this, whereas appreciation, that side of the coin, comes from the narrative. So we may actually, if we know that avatar as other orientations tend to pay more attention to the narrative, they may be more likely to actually get those types of eudaimonic or appreciative experiences out of their gameplay. That's a possibility.
Cool. Sounds like there's a lot of interesting research yet to be done, and some careers to be made, and and papers to be published. Yeah. So, you know, everything that we've talked about so far, is there anything that game designers, any takeaway for people that actually make games that they would want to keep in mind to either try to effect different types of relationships and interactions, or should that even be a goal or an objective?
You know, I don't think we have, because we don't have a clear idea about all of the different types of effects of these different types of orientations, I don't know that I have I can offer something definitive in that direction. But what we do know is that, you know, players of all different types of avatar orientations do still feel committed to them. You know, when we're talking about an avatar as object, a lot of times those players see their avatars as trophies, right? Mm-hmm. And so when we're thinking about multiplayer online games where that might be subscription-based or require continued play over long periods of time, that can actually be really powerful, right? I don't want to stop my subscription because that's my trophy.
Yeah.
That's where I keep all my stuff, you know?
So they could just threaten to kill your avatar if you unsubscribe.
Right. Exactly. Yeah. And, you know, on the other end of the spectrum, we have this idea that your avatar is a companion, where I've heard people say exactly, you know, parallel things. That's like, I keep paying my $15 a month for a while because I can't imagine not being able to access my avatar. That is to log in and see it and to know that it's there and it's real.
Right. And so, I wonder if things like the WoW Armory and other sort of mobile device apps that allow you to access information about your avatars or see your avatars and their outfits and so forth, no matter where you are, might play into that as well.
Yeah. And I'm not going to lie. Like the first time I logged into Armory and it was all grayed out because I hadn't logged in a long time, I felt a little funny. I'm not gonna lie about it.
So. It's like finding all the cockroaches and weeds in Animal Crossing if you've been away from it for months.
Right.
Great. So anything else that you wanted to talk about?
So we've done about more than a dozen studies using these two approaches so far across more than 5,000 gamers. So we're pretty solid in thinking that this is a really good and reliable approach to thinking about these types of relationships. We've tested them across genres, across demographics. We've even tested it with Dungeons and Dragons characters.
And I was going to ask about that. Yeah, does this generalize to tabletop role-playing games like D&D? Yeah.
The models all still hold up. And when I say that, I mean like all of these clusters of ideas still tend to hold together. And the other cool thing about this is that I found it endures over time. I did a longitudinal study where I had people answer this survey at 3 points in time, where in between the first and the second points, WoW had done their model upgrades a couple of years ago. Mm-hmm. Even with the character upgrades, the changes in the aesthetics, people's orientations to their avatars still held up. They did not change over time. Huh. So these are pretty enduring orientations. And, you know, that's kind of a cool thing to know, because it does validate this social perspective that these are, to some extent or another, relationships that develop over time. But it has also been a really challenging situation for us when it comes to studying those effects questions, because we did actually try a study, an experiment, where we had people play a serious game that we created in cooperation with some developers. And in one version, we tried to force players into a me orientation through pronouns, through different forms of language, through different interface features, through first person perspective. Mm-hmm. And then to force the other group into a differentiated or avatar as other perspective through the same types of features. We could not do it.
Yeah, no effect, no ability to change their perspective, huh?
Exactly. The manipulation, we failed, as we say it.
Yeah.
But what was something really cool that came out of that is that the study was about, can forcing you into one of these orientations induce different levels of empathy toward the other characters in the game? Well, because we were measuring empathy, turns out the greatest predictor of your orientation towards your avatar, at least in that sample, in that study, was your trait empathy. Hmm. Your personal tendency to be empathetic toward others.
Yeah, persistent trait that across situations and time to be empathetic. Yeah.
And the cool thing about that is that it suggests that, you know, if that's our persistent tendency to treat other people, and they usually include how we treat animals in trait empathy, that's the same way we're treating our avatars.
That's interesting.
Yeah. Right. So they become, to some extent or another, sort of just this other analog for a social being.
Yeah.
As a class of thing in the world.
All right. So this is all really interesting stuff. Where can people go on the internet to find out more about you and what you're up to?
So you can find me on Google Scholar. That's just scholar.google.com. I have got most of my published articles are up there. On Twitter, I am at AmperJ. That's A-M as in Mary, P-E-R-J-A-Y. Okay. And you can find me on WVU Department of Communication Studies website.
Yeah, and I'll include links to those things as well. Well, thanks for coming on. One last question I always like to ask is, have you been playing anything? Have you had any time lately to actually play any video games outside of work?
Well, you know that BFA came out for WoW, and WoW is my jam, so that's where I've been hanging out lately.
Battle for Azeroth, right, yeah.
Indeed. But outside of that, you know, I really enjoy a lot of sort of narratively driven indie games, so I have gotten about 80% completion on Fez. That's been sort of the side project.
That's a deep dig. Yeah.
So that's the side project, and mostly making fun of my husband as he plays retro games, making fun of the bosses, you know.
Very nice. Yeah, I've just recently picked up Marvel's Spider-Man from Insomniac.
I've been hearing a lot about it. I have not played it myself yet.
It's really good. But you know, I'm not like a big Spider-Man fan. I never read the comics or anything, but I picked up enough through just sort of cultural osmosis and, you know, movies and such to kind of know what his deal is and appreciate the game.
Sure.
It's an incredibly expensive looking game. Like, they spent so much money and so many hours of labor just polishing this thing and building every little thing into it and fine tuning it to where it just feels so smooth and nice. So great.
Nice.
Yeah. Having a lot of time. I'm hunting around New York for all those hidden trophies and backpacks and taking pictures of landmarks and stuff and putting off actually doing any of the main story stuff. Just one, because I don't really want it to end. And two, I'm just having fun like web slinging around the town. They made that feel really good. And it's just fun to move from point A to point B in that game.
Cool. That's how I feel about Lego Marvel.
Yeah. Yeah, I played a lot of Lego Marvel, but a lot of those old games like Lego Harry Potter and Star Wars with my kids when they were younger. So yeah, definitely remember that as well. Yeah, and new release season is like gearing up. So there's like every week or 2 weeks from here on out through December, it seems like there's a new game coming out or a new expansion pack or DLC or something that I enjoy.
That's a good but expensive problem to have.
Yeah. Yeah. Eventually I'm going to have to decide which one is going to be, you know, my 2019 summer lull, you know, that I dip into sure. When things slow down a little bit. But yeah, it's a good problem to have. I'm not complaining. Well, thanks again so much for coming on. This was a really interesting conversation. And these were topics that I've sort of heard about piecemeal. And it was really great to have somebody like yourself lay them down in a sequence that makes, you know, sense and connect the dots and connect the puzzle pieces so that the bigger picture reveals itself. And I guess there's still more of the big picture to be revealed.
Plenty.
Yeah, which means that people like yourselves are doing interesting work that we'll have to stay tuned to and pay attention to.
For sure. I'm so glad I could share it with you guys.
All right, great. Hey, thanks for making it to the end of another Psychology of Games podcast. Before we part ways, remember three things. One, go visit psychologyofgames.com. Two, follow and share on Twitter and Facebook. Three, patreon.com/POG to support me directly if you'd like and if you can. Thanks so much for listening, and I'll talk to you next episode.